Hi, everyone. Welcome to Glitchy Pancakes, real talk about the world of fandom. I'm Allie.
I'm Rob.
And I'm Jesse.
And in today's episode, we're discussing own voices fiction, what it means, whom it affects, and why it's so important to the world of speculative fiction. Joining us, we have two important voices in the genre fiction world. Up first is a returning guest, one of our favorites, in fact, the very first guest ever hosted by Glitchy Pancakes. She is the editor of two groundbreaking world fantasy award-winning Black speculative fiction anthologies entitled Dark Matter from 2000 and 2004, and is also the author of the short story collection Nine Bar Blues, Stories from an Ancient Future. She has a short story in the upcoming Marvel anthology, Black Panther, Tales of Wakanda, and will co-host the 2021 Hugo Awards at Worldcon. Welcome back, Cherie Renee Thomas.
Hi, welcome.
Hi.
Thank you. Hey. You forgot my most illustrious new title. I'm shocked.
Also joining us, we have an author, editor, and teacher with short stories in magazines like Strange Horizons and Electric Velocipede, and nonfiction pieces on NPR, IO9, and Tor.com. She teaches writing classes through Writing the Other, the Rambo Academy for Wayward Writers, Lit Reactor, and more. She is deeply involved in the science fiction and fantasy community through fundraising efforts, convention involvement, and is vice chair of the Carl Brandon Society, a nonprofit addressing race, ethnicity, culture, and inclusivity in speculative fiction. Welcome, Kay Tempest Bradford.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on, you two. We're really glad to have you on.
Awesome.
Yes, thank you for being here from multiple time zones.
Yes.
Appreciate it. It's one of the best parts about podcasting in the current world is no one expects to go out to an actual studio anymore. So we can just grab people from all over the country.
Right.
Yeah.
It's so great.
Yeah. So how are things where y'all are? How are you doing?
It's rainy and cold here in Portland, Oregon, and it's going to be that way all the way until April.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So at least it's not out of the ordinary.
Not out of the ordinary, but I'm new to Portland and I'm just like, ugh. Oh, yeah. I used to go to Florida in the winter, but I can't.
Right.
You know,
right.
That thing.
Yes. And Florida has done such a bang up job of managing things that, yeah.
Right. I'm just like, but I just want to be where it's sunny and 85 degrees on Christmas Day. But right. I guess not. I guess I'll just have to hang out here where it's awesome in Portland. Yeah.
But Florida, it's like, even if you could travel safely, you still couldn't travel safely to Florida right now.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well,
how about you, Cherie?
Biblical rains in Memphis.
Scaring the animals.
Yeah.
You guys are not underneath any kind of flood warnings, are you?
Not that I'm aware of. It's just kind of weird. And I knew something was going to happen because it was unnaturally warm last week, and then it got super cold, and then it got very still. And I'm only a few streets away from the Mississippi River, and all that lets me know that some drama's coming.
That's when it gets scary, is when it gets still outside, because you're like, somebody's planning something.
Yes, the stillness is the sign. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Well, we wanted to talk about own voices fiction. This is a really important thing that's in the last few years seems to be getting more and more spotlight on it, which is great. But there still might be a lot of people listening who aren't really familiar with the term own voices and exactly what it means. We've had some folks say, what exactly is that? So to start out, what exactly does this term mean in the context of speculative fiction or fiction in general?
Okay. Well, the term own voices in the hashtag was started by an author, and I have only ever seen their name in print, and so I do not know how to pronounce it, but I believe it's Corinne Divis.
I think it's Doivis. I looked it up because I had the exact same problem.
Yeah. And so, Corinne Doivis. And when they came up with this term and coined it and coined the hashtag, it was really about highlighting fiction that was written by people who matched the, you know, characters, the protagonists in their book, and their experiences matched the experiences or the identity experiences of the people that they were writing about, and specifically focusing on marginalized authors. And that is because it's important for books that are about Black people, say, as an example, or Black experiences, to be written by folks who are Black people who right. have had Black experiences.
Right.
And it's important to raise those voices up. And it wasn't exactly like, say, a pushback, but I think that like Own Voices is very much in conversation with the term writing the other, which mm-hmm. I'm very familiar with because right. I teach classes in writing the other. And there are times when I feel like people want to act like Own Voices and writing the other need to be in a fight, right? But like Niecy Shawl, who is the one who was the co-author of the Writing the Other book, along with Cynthia Ward, and right. who's my teaching partner, we don't see it that way. We think that writing the other is important because representation is important. But Own Voices is also important. And we need to have a world in which it is possible for people who come from any marginalized identity, be that, you know, a marginalized racial group, if you're marginalized because you're disabled, because you are non-binary, you know, whatever it is, to be able to tell their stories. But it's also important for writers who come from, you know, any identity, but most importantly, people who come from what we call the dominant paradigm, you know, those folks who are white males who are heterosexual and cisgender and middle class, et cetera, et cetera, right. to also include everybody in their books. I mean, not like literally everybody in one book, but like realistically include people from lots of different identities. We need to have both. However, we don't need publishers to only publish books about Black people by white writers.
Right.
We
right.
need them Definitely to publish everybody, and we need them to give equal time to Black writers writing about Black experiences, disabled people writing about disabled experiences, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. It makes sense. It only makes sense to have that type of experience. And we had Niecy and Cynthia on recently, a few months back, and it was fantastic. They taught us a lot about writing the other, and I'm glad that you're involved with that. So like with Own Voices, like what type of problems existed and still exist in publishing that necessitate a focus on this particular issue, Cherie?
The problem is that it's the same people. It was the same people at the rooms, in the editorial rooms. Right. When I was editing books, you know, there were very few Black people. Or other people that were in the editorial departments. They might have been in the art department. They might have been with the subsidiary rights, or in the marketing area, but they weren't in the editorial rooms. And I don't know if people realize how much power there is in a big five publishing house. You might have a dozen people, the various editors and their assistants, and the VPs and the art directors, publishing people sitting in a room every Monday or Wednesday or whenever they have their editorial meetings, and they go through all the submissions that they feel one are worth discussing, ones that they're particularly excited about, and they want to highlight, others that they might be on the fence about or they have questions about, or they might need some assistance with. And they also kind of discuss why they want to publish a certain, or why they want to make an offer, and why they want to pass. And they are pretty much the ones who decide all of the thousands of books that are published in English in this country and distributed. And so they are very much aware, at least the ones I worked with, were very much aware that they were influencers. And that they were the ones who were reinscribing certain narratives in the culture, and the ones who might be in a position to add on them or revise and expand the conversation. But the other thing that was difficult about it is that a lot of the work that was coming through was coming from people in places and communities that were not their areas of expertise. Right. And so you are in a remarkable position where you have people who know very little about, let's say, Black culture in America, let alone anywhere else in the diaspora, who are making these powerful decisions about what the work is, what it means, what it says, and what it can do, and how it will be have an impact in the world beyond, you know, the avenues where these publishing companies are. So, that's problematic when you don't have more people in the room, more diversity in the room. And as Corinne was saying, not just diversity of the books themselves, but of the people who are creating those works. This, you don't have any, if you don't have many disabled people or bisexual people or people of color in the room to talk about the nuances and the complexities of the work, then a lot's going to be missed, you know?
Right.
You know, all the way from the marketing and promotion, all the way down to the content, you know, the content itself. So that, you know, that can be an issue. And in my early career, I was a part of a lot of different communities. And one of those was the National Writers Union, which had an open book committee. And part of that work was not just, you know, consulting, you know, working with the contracts grievance department and things like that, that we had, or even working to get health insurance and everything through the union contacts that we had, the alliances that we had, but it was also exploring this issue of diversity, not just in the books themselves, but in publishing. And one of the people that was particularly passionate about it at that time in his career was Walter Mosley, who was working actively with the Penn Writers Organization. And they had a committee as well. And the goal of it, at least we thought the goal of it, was to bring more diversity into the building itself, into the buildings, into the publishing companies,
right.
You know, so that they can move up and be a part of the conversation of this culture building that publishing is really about, whether they want to acknowledge it or not, right? And so there was just this, it was a thing where it, they felt like having the conversation was enough to give yourself a gold star versus actually doing the work and seeing visible change. And so he, of course, being as prolific and busy as he was, moved right on very quickly when he realized that it was just going to be, they were comfortable being in the realm of let's have a conversation versus let's hire some people and empower them and pay them enough where they can actually afford to be working in publishing at that in New York City, you know, so
you mentioned the I hadn't really thought of it that way about the small number of people who are making all the decisions, because, like, you know, a lot of people know that there are the big five publishing houses, soon to possibly be the big four, and so, and you're talking about a dozen people making the big calls for thousands and thousands of books, that's a few dozen people making these choices. So it makes absolute sense that if it's all, you know, the dominant paradigm that are making the decision, then they're going to miss. You mentioned the content, you mentioned the marketing and all that stuff. So that seems how it's like probably how some of the more egregious examples of that have really brought the own voices conversation into the spotlight. A lot of those things have gotten through, specifically people not from the group that their protagonist is a part of, writing and doing it very poorly, doing it in ways that end up being very offensive and insensitive and just fall flat in a lot of ways. That does seem to be a huge issue, that if you don't have more, a more diverse group in the rooms making those calls, then even well-intentioned people are still going to screw it up. And it doesn't necessarily track that they're even that well-intentioned if they're comfortable enough just keeping things the way they are.
And they also have to have power when they're in the room, because it's not enough just to be in the room. Mm-hmm. Is your voice being heard? You know, is it being honored? You know, is your area of expertise being acknowledged? Because what I found is that a lot of times they will argue with you and say they know Black people more than you do, and they don't even know anybody more than you. Being all the way real about it, like you literally don't know anyone besides me in the mailroom. So
I've heard a lot of stories like that, and so it doesn't surprise me one bit. And it's also an issue of, you know, a lot of times there's a lot of focus on, okay, like is the editor a person who is, you know, a person of color, or they have disability or something else that's different from what is considered like mainstream. But the thing that often doesn't get taken into account is the people in the marketing department as well. Mm-hmm. Because the other thing that's apparently, this is semi-new, and probably a result of like all this consolidation of publishing houses, is that when people go into that meeting, that editorial meeting, and they're like, I want to buy this book. And you could have the wokest editor ever who's like, yeah, I want to buy all these books about Black boy joy, Black girl magic, and all this stuff. And the marketing people are like, we don't know how to market that.
Oh, so God.
You can't buy it.
Oh, wow.
And that happens a lot. Like, if they can't convince the marketing department, then the book doesn't get bought.
Do they read? I mean, if they can just read see that it's excellent material, then they can go, well, now I know how to market this because it's good.
Right.
It's not that difficult.
Yeah. And I don't know, like, all the inner workings of that process, but, like, I have, like, heard enough from people who are in publishing that, like, this is what happens. Like, an editor from a smaller press was talking to me about how, like, now whenever they have these editorial meetings, the marketing department has to be there, because previously they would buy a book and they love the book and the book would go through all the steps and it's fine, it's ready to go out, and they'd be like, okay, marketing, do your job. And marketing's like, I don't know what to do with that. So wow. I'm like, well, but see, from my perspective, I'm just like, then learn how to,
right?
Yeah, or exactly. Hire someone like, who that does
job, like,
yeah. So,
yeah, I think it's backwards, but it does sound very corporate, which is,
oh yeah,
yeah, what it comes down to a lot with publishing. You know, you have, yeah, a lot of people in publishing who care about books and they care about reading and they care about representation, but in the end it is still a corporation.
Mm-hmm. Right. We approach that same situation in comics when people don't know how to color a character properly.
Yeah.
You approach that same situation. It's like, it, you know, if you give it to someone who maybe is Black or is Hispanic or can, you know, have, or is Native, knows how to color that particular person, or someone who just knows how to do it, it's not hard to get that shading right. If you're an artist, it's not that difficult to do that. It shouldn't be that, yeah, difficult to do that.
Yeah, it seems like the thing, I like what I'm hearing about, like, this, okay, you don't know how to do it, then either learn or, yeah, hire somebody, like I said, hire somebody who does know how to do it. Like,
they don't want the money. They don't want that money. They're not after that money. I mean, if they knew the talent, just the raw talent that was out there, they I don't know. Maybe they're just not listening. We're being dismissed.
And it seems like with, like, it's been since, what, 2015, I think, since the hashtag was created. And, you know, of course, there was work being done on this beforehand, but that's when it kind of took on this particular term. But Sheree, what you brought up about the publishing and there not being a diverse enough group in the important rooms, that, based on the numbers that keep coming out, that doesn't seem to have improved, or it doesn't seem to be improving, which is a really frustrating thing to see, because I can't see how anyone can justify the argument that, like, even just a cynical corporate argument that the market's not there or whatever else. Like, how can you justify that at this point? It's simply untrue. But the numbers aren't changing, despite everyone's best efforts. So
it's not everyone's best efforts. That's the thing.
Oh, okay.
There it is.
All right.
That's what I was waiting on.
I mean, I think part of the thing that we come up against is this, you know, this assumption that our, you know, people's goals for diversity or whatever, the goals that are, you know, they're all over the place, that everyone has, mm-hmm, the same goal. If that were the case, this wouldn't even be a conversation in the 21st century.
That's right.
It wouldn't be a conversation. I like the same conversations that we were having when I left Memphis in the 90s and went to go work in publishing and sell books at Forbidden Planet on the side and write jacket copy and do proofreading and copy editing, taking copy editing classes at New York University and all the things I did to learn what I needed to learn to do what I wanted to do. This wouldn't be a conversation 20 some years, like 25 plus years, mm-hmm, later. So it's not a lack of trying. And we have even more sophisticated tools, even more vocal, braver, bolder, you know, activists and writers who are talking about this and organizing. It's data driven, the conversations, et cetera. So what does that tell you? It's a cultural thing, like so many other things in this country. I can't speak for other shores, that the people with power have to make a decision that they want to actually change. And until they actually want to change, it's going to be what it's going to be. It's going to be what it is. And I think understanding what we mean when we say this is a culture enforcing industry that isn't very profitable, okay, to be honest. Romances pretty much pay for everything else. This is the bread and butter of the industry. It pretty much has been that way for a very long time. When they moved from, you know, it being individuals who were publishing writers, you know, the basis for these imprints. Right. And when it became something else, well, you have to look at what is actually generating the sales. And romance is an industry where people from age 8 to 80 can read those books, and they will age up in those books. And no matter what their socioeconomic background is, you could be a rocket scientist, you could be a kindergarten teacher, you can be a stripper, you can be a grandmother, a dancer, anything. You can read a romance and love it and enjoy it. And so it has a huge audience. And it allows us to publish literary books that get a lot of critical acclaim but don't sell a lot. It allows us to publish short story collections and anthologies and dog books and garden books and, right. and yoga meditation books and wherever else it is. So that's where the money really is in the industry. And I mentioned that because everything else is a work of labor, a love, really. Mm-hmm. And as Tempest was saying, having the sales force in the room, having them not just get the catalog at the end, you know, in the middle of the quarter, whatever, when you have the big, you know, when the editors pitch all their books to the sales force, so they'll know how to go and sell it to the distributors and the booksellers and the people who are with the trucks carrying the books around and all that. Now they're in the room because after all these multiple mergers, there's more of the desire to be more conscious of the profit and loss. The P&L is not an after statement or afterthought. It's the opening thought. So, and I only knew one Black salesperson. I'm sure there were others, but that was Manny Barron, you know, the Manny Barron who worked with LA Banks, who did some of the Chester Himes books and the other things that he was working on before he, you know, started doing editorial work full time. Before he passed on. And that was the only one that I knew of. So we're not necessarily even in those spaces, you know? So everything else being a labor of love that you hope will be profitable, not that they aren't in some extent, but I'm just saying there is this sense that if you change the paradigm too much, you change the culture. And it's like, it's sort of you, if you would look at recruitment efforts for universities and colleges, right? There's a certain amount, minimum amount of minorities you're supposed to have in order to get federal funding, right?
Right.
They don't go above that.
Right. They do not.
Don't make an active effort
across
to, right?
the country. And that's not because they don't have the numbers to do that, because if this were actually about a meritocracy, guess what? Harvard would probably be mostly Asian. You know what I mean? But
yeah.
You know, the conversations are always, like I say, they're always punching down. They're always looking at the three Negroes or three Africans and the others of the diaspora who managed to make it into the university, but they're not looking at all the other mediocre white people who are also there, or the legacies who are, you know, who are alum or children of children who went there, or what went to the great, you know, feeder private school, boarding schools or whatever, and are recruited or what have you. They're not looking at those numbers and saying, guess what? You know, they've taken our spots. They're looking at the easy target, right?
Right.
So, but if we're actually going to talk about it, you would have to say, well, why are the numbers only at this level? And why aren't they here? Well, we know there's a huge community of people of color from all over the world.
That's right.
Who meet the requirements or surpass the requirements and want to be at the school. And some of the internationals can afford to be in the schools, you know, on their own without any financial aid. Why aren't there more of them being accepted? Well, because that would change the culture of the campus.
Oh, yeah.
So okay. Culture needs to change.
So they don't do it. Yeah. And you only need a minimum to get the federal funding and keep it moving. So there you go.
A lot of people, there people are afraid of evolution on a most fundamental level. Yeah, it's really hard to understand how they don't see how these things, how diversity makes things just better.
Yeah, it's their thought that it doesn't. I mean, that's the big thing is like, you know, they're not shown the happy, shiny future. They're right. shown like these sort of dystopic visions of what it's like when the white people aren't in charge. I was actually just reading a really interesting article that was about Cyberpunk 2077. I think that's what the game is called. And also about the cyberpunk genre in toto and talking about how, at least like from the trailers, like nobody who was interviewed for this article had actually played the game. Right. But from the trailers, they were like, they are bouncing off a lot of tired cyberpunk tropes that were problematic when cyberpunk was new and cyberpunk ain't new no more. We still have these tropes. And a lot of them are like that sort of yellow peril, like, oh yes, it's a future in which, you know, there's Chinese script on the side of the building and oh no, the Chinese have taken over. Do we see any Chinese people? No, but they took over. Is anybody actually speaking Mandarin here in Firefly? No, they're not.
Right. Yeah, like the end of the families, right? Do we see their families? Are they there? Right. Wives, their husbands, their children, their siblings, like are they family units? We don't even see that, right?
Right. You just see like apparently there's like a whole gang in Cyberpunk 2077 that they all have katanas. And I'm like, why?
As I'm not buying that for a lot of reasons, but
and I don't know a ton about it, but I did find like just them talking about cyberpunk in general just very interesting. So yeah, I think that, you know, a lot of times they're like, our culture is very focused on like, oh, the dangers of what happens when white people aren't the majority anymore, and not enough on just like, what if everybody was like allowed to just be awesome by themselves? Which is why, you know, Own Voices fiction actually is like so important. And even though it's hard to get published as compared to like, you know, white folks just write about whatever, it's still so important for it to happen, like so important, because like each person who gets an Own Voices book published is like opening a door for like two other people to do it. And so it still needs to happen, and it's like, it's frustrating, and there's a lot to complain about as a writer of color, but it's just necessary.
Right. Absolutely. It seems like it's also got a, like, there's a big benefit to readers too. You know, like I haven't written anything, but I read speculative fiction all the time. And it gives readers a window, like a legitimate, like an authentic window into, you're talking about like the fear of other cultures and the fear of, you know, the, of white people not being in charge of everything anymore. That I feel like it could lessen that somewhat if they got, you know, realistic, authentic windows into the cultures that they're nebulously afraid of, right? Like they could see, like that seems an important part of it too, that they're actually like expose people to these cultures that if they're not exposed to them, or if they just see, you know, the representations of them that are written by white people that miss a lot, like, you know, miss the mark pretty badly if that's all they're seeing, or they're not seeing it at all, then it kind of perpetuates being unfamiliar with those cultures, and you know, unfamiliarity breeds fear, and that, I don't know, that probably contributes to the status quo remaining right where it is.
You know, what's crazy as well is that in some of these stories where people of color or different people in general are portrayed wrong, it sometimes this is the first introduction to someone who looks like that to someone who doesn't look like that, or doesn't act like that, or aren't like that. So it does everyone a disservice when it's not written properly.
Right. Aside from also just, you know, taking that publishing spot away from someone
absolutely
who should have had the chance to write it. Yeah.
Absolutely. But it's wrong in so many different ways on so many different levels.
Well, if we look at the like more kind of the nuts and bolts of like the writing aspect of it, because that's really interesting stuff about the way that the actual publishing industry you know, keeps perpetuating itself and the way that things are done. But as far as the writing side of it, I noticed, Tempest, what you said first focused a bit on the protagonist in particular.
Right.
When we talk about own voices fiction, does that largely focus on the protagonist? Because I've seen confusion from people about this, like what, mm-hmm. you know, what characters, it's about who's telling what stories. And a lot of people seem confused about what characters they can write. Is there a difference between protagonists and supporting characters as far as who should tell which stories?
Yeah, that's a big, big, like, continuing fight, I feel like, and discussion. And, you know, what it is with protagonists, it's because they have like such a special place as characters in whatever work of fiction, and especially if they're POV characters. Because if you got a protagonist and they're a POV character, then you are speaking from inside of their head, whether you've written it in first person or third or second, you're coming from inside of this protagonist's head if you're writing in their POV.
Right.
And to do that with a character who is very different from you on some identity axis, be it race, ability, sexual orientation, gender, class, body type, you know, any of the big ones, that takes a lot of skill. And so what we often tell our students is that we're not going to tell you that you can't do that, but what we will tell you is that you need to build up some skills before you attempt that, right? It's like,
right.
You're like, I'm going to learn to swim today. You don't jump into the deep end of the Olympic-sized pool and expect to, like, beat Michael Phelps to the end of it, right?
Right.
We don't do that. Like, we start with just, like, some simple stuff, right? So, you know, and it's the same with these writing skills. Like, writing the other is a skill.
Right.
And so in order to build up that skill, you don't start with the POV protagonist. You start with other characters in the work. You can even start with just having people who exist in the world, even if, you know, they aren't like keys to the plot or whatever, but they exist. And so therefore it's like, oh, look, that person exists. They, you know, this world is a world in which that person can exist and it's fine. And it's not a problem. It's not the problem of the work. They exist. Like, right. If we could just have a bunch of that, it would be so nice. Yes. It would be a really good first step.
Yes.
But you will find a lot of writers, especially writers of color, who will be like, don't write protagonists who are out of your lane. And they'll say, like, they'll just straight up, they'll be like, don't do it. And I understand why they say don't do it, because mm-hmm. it's so many people do it carelessly that, like, at some point you just go, like, just don't, just stop. Yeah. I don't want to see it anymore. Nisi and I always tell people, like, we can't tell you what to do, but we can give you some good guidelines. And it's like, there are white authors that I would trust to have done the work to do it well. So if they say to me, like, I wrote a book and it's a POV and it's a woman of color, it, you know, if I have seen that writer do the work, I'm like, all right, I'll read it.
Right.
But if I have not seen you do the work and you're a garbage fire on Twitter, I'm not looking at that. So yeah, it's just that, you know, there are so many writers who have not put in the work and they make everything worse for everybody else. So yeah, like, just the guideline that we give, start with other characters in the work. Don't start with a protagonist. Don't start with a deep POV character. Start with other characters. Build those skills, because it's, you know, it's hard work building the skill of, like, understanding somebody who's very different from you, especially if you come from what is considered the mainstream, right? If you're in America and you're white, right, and you're middle class, like, because you haven't been given the inherent skills to understand other people. You have actually been blocked by our culture from having empathy with people who aren't like you. And so it's going to be mm-hmm. harder for you mm-hmm. to, like, break that conditioning. That's not your fault.
That's right.
But it's still there. It's really hard to break that conditioning, reform, like, what you got to do, and start doing research and start learning about other people.
Yeah, that's an interesting point about how, like, that people are, without realizing it, are conditioned against empathy for right. people who aren't like them and don't share their experiences. And then that's some work that readers can do too.
And it's kind of interesting that because white people are the predominant, you know, group that have been badly running things for so long. I would say more BIPOC folks understand white quote unquote culture entirely well enough to write white people, because, you know, there's like the code switching, there's learning to work within these constraints that the culture has put up. But alternately, no, not white people do not have that innate ability.
Yeah, it seems that way, and that's an interesting point, that it's very different, you know, when it flows back in the other direction, very different, just because of the, you know, the state of the world we live in, the state of our country, and how it's been for, well, as long as it's existed. And I like, Tim, as you mentioned a couple of times, doing the work, like on the part of writers, doing the work to really to understand who it is you're writing about, and to start small, you know, do it thoughtfully and do it carefully. It seems like there's definitely work that readers can do too, because a lot of this comes down to, you know, like Sheree was saying, there's not the marketing behind it. There's not the editorial support in a lot of cases. It seems like it would help that a bit if more readers were actively asking for it. So that's something that we always like to do when we can, is to, you know, give readers and people who might be listening ideas on what they can do to better move this along in a good direction. And it seems like you can specifically look at the books you're considering buying and,
right,
you know, find out does this qualify? Like if the protagonist of this book, for example, is a member of a traditionally marginalized group, or if it specifically relates to a culture of that type, then look and see who wrote it. And, yep, you know, maybe give it a pass if it doesn't, if the author is not somebody who is actually part of that group. Because that work is out there, you know, it's out there to be found. If people do a little work and look for it, and, you know, actively asking for it from publishers, I would hope would make a difference. I mean, you think it would? Do they listen?
I mean, Sheree might be able to tell better, like, how much publishers listen to the reading public, because I know that, like, a lot of times, I remember when I first started in our genre, just talking about the problems of representation, the lack of representation, and hearing from people like, well, it's just not good business sense to leave out women because women buy things. So nobody would do that. And I'm like, I'm sorry, but people are doing that right now. Yep. Like you are standing next to the guy who's been doing it for 10 years. Like, I don't understand. I don't know what to tell you. And so, yeah, it's like, it doesn't always seem to be just a purely based on like how much money can we make decision, which I think Robert like talked about before. I mean, sometimes it is, because let me tell you, the number of Black people who were called up by editors the day after Black Panther premiered, right? And people were like, wait a minute, so I remember something about you had a book about some Black people who were doing some magical, can you just send me that? And I'm like, really? Editors, okay, cool, I see what you're doing. But sometimes that's what it takes. Like, it takes a cultural moment like that, and for other people to be like, let's jump on this cultural moment because it's going to make us a ton more money. Like, okay, cool. If that's how it's going to be, sometimes that's how it's going to be. But the decisions aren't always like made along those lines, because like, yeah, they could be making bank if they just appeal to more people.
All the money.
Right? But sometimes that doesn't happen.
It's not about the money all the time, because there hasn't been a single Black movie that's been made that lost money. Not a single, all the way back to the Black exploitation era, already back to,
right, I was about to say Hollywood Shuffle.
Spencer Williams, I can go back into Black and white movies.
You can,
there hasn't been a single Black movie that's lost money.
Right.
That isn't always, as Tempest said, that's not always the motivating force, right? They might tell you, it might not reach this huge audience, but Black movies don't lose money. So that's not what it's about. The question is, why did The Help do so well? Almost all the people my generation have grandparents who, some of them at some point, a lot of them, have been domestics, right?
Right.
Have been working in other white families' homes, right? And then would come home to their families, who were lunch ladies or what have you, right?
Mm-hmm.
the people who were written out of the New Deal. Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
You mean to tell me none of them or their daughters who went on to become doctors,
right,
and PhDs and study, you know, this history and what have you, and have old books about it. There's a whole like society of Black historians in this country, right? Mm-hmm. You mean to tell me no one ever wrote a book about the civil rights movement in Jackson, Mississippi, yep, from the eyes, right, of the regular people who were part of it, impacted by it?
Right.
So the question is, if a book by a Black woman domestic is written, a novel, and a book by a white girl who's the child of a family who was able to afford a Black woman domestic in their house, and right, and very nakedly wrote a book based sort of on that woman's life without her permission, and since
right,
proofs after the fact, after it's already a done deal, right? Mm-hmm. Which one do you think is going to get greenlit in the room of a dozen people? It's going to be the book that's written to translate that culture,
right,
that history to the audience. That's the majority audience in the country, because they feel more comfortable having works,
right,
that are written with them centered in it,
right,
where the stories are translated to them so that it's about them. They're a part of it, but they don't feel too guilty because they're the hero, yeah, in the story,
yeah,
et cetera. That's the thing. And that's, yeah, not a money decision all the time. That's a culture, yeah, decision. That's a power,
you're right,
decision.
You're right.
Sounds absolutely right. And once again, like, which one gets greenlit goes back to what you were saying about who's in that room.
You're right.
And who is empowered in the room.
Right, right. I got it.
But they'll put you out very quickly. Like, there has just been a whole, you know, people laid off that we're all puzzled why these people were laid off. You know, their books were successful. They were successful. You know, so what is it? Is this the last hired first? You know, first fired, right, or what is the situation? You know, what is going on? And, you know, so you're there, but you're expendable, you know? So,
Let me ask you a question, Cherie. So why is it that when they need a science expert, they'll go to a scientist, but they won't even think twice about speaking to someone who's not them to actually, you know, they have like writing the other, is now a thing, and people have the ability to do that, but it boggles my mind how, you know, years ago, even before that came to be, why people just didn't say, hey, I'm not an expert on Black culture, so let me go speak to Black people. I know some people did, but how, I guess culture also stopped them from doing that because they thought maybe something bad was going to happen to them by simply talking to someone who doesn't look like them.
Or they didn't know anyone who didn't look like them. No, I mean, seriously, I go back to my hometown and people there, a lot of them don't know anyone who doesn't look like them, believe like them, you know.
But I don't get how you can thrive for authenticity and not
be
authentic.
You don't have to thrive for authenticity. Yeah. You're still going to get the contract. Right. You're still going to get the good reviews. Going to have an audience. You don't need authenticity. I'm just thinking of the way it was in the past. I'm just I'm thinking of like even the children's book industry.
Yes.
I raised children. They're adults now. I was a child once. I remember the books. And in terms of like for books for Black children, a lot of those books were written by non-Black people. Mm-hmm. It was a whole cottage industry. I think that was kind of revealed in the romance industry recently. Like you can just have a stable of writers that you feel comfortable with, and they'll just go down the encyclopedia of Black history letter by letter until they get to Zora Neale Hurston or whatever, you know, mm-hmm, and write a book because they know that they're going to be able to get a contract and be able to do it, and it'll be out, and they'll put maybe a Black, you know, illustrations on the cover, and families will think that it was written by someone Black, mm-hmm, because of the subject matter. But most of the time it was not. There was Walter D. Myers. There was Lucille Clifton had done some children's books. I remember books, of course, that had beautiful covers by Leo and Diane Dillon, you know, Virginia Hamilton was doing these books. It was a wonderful family. It's just so many of them. The Cummings family doing a lot of books, but no, mostly non-white people. And so, and there wasn't any pushback. There wasn't any question about it. It was just like, let me go and do the research and I can come up with a children's book. Yeah, there wasn't there wasn't a belief that you had to have beta readers or what have you. And there wasn't a sense that you needed to be held accountable to anyone because that was just the norm. That was the tradition, you know?
Yeah, there's also a pervasive idea among some white people that like, not necessarily that they are experts in other people's culture or experiences, but that no other people have experiences that they don't grok or right. that they couldn't understand easily. Right. And I remember the very first time I encountered this, I went to Clarion West in 2003. And there was a white dude in my Clarion West cohort who was getting an MFA, actually. And it's like the MFA people are always the worst in the genre. I don't know why. and he was also a white man with dreads. And so like that tells you everything you need to know, right, about him. Right. And he literally said to me that as a black person, I didn't have any more expertise on what it meant to be black than he did.
What in the hell?
Right. Like he literally directly said that to me. And I was just like, what is happening now? And that was the first time I had personally encountered that. Now I've encountered a lot since then, especially in this genre. But there is a belief because again, you have people who are raised in a culture that like makes it seem like their culture is normal and that everybody should understand it, right? And this is going back to something I think Ali said earlier, where it's like, yeah, a black person can totally write a convincing white character because we're surrounded by them every day, right? Like they're in all our media and they're all up in our business. And, you know, like, we're just like, we're bombarded with white people culture. We're mired in it. We're marinated in it. So yeah, like our, you know, we have our own cultural things, but like we have to exist in this dominant culture that, you know, like pushes all these things at us. But then there's no cognizance from a lot of the people who are part of the dominant group that isn't normal for everybody and that not everybody has access to understanding of it. And like, and it shows up in their fiction, you know, quite honestly, like we talk about this a lot, especially when it comes to exposition, because like I have a lot of feelings about exposition. I won't give them all to you because like that's a whole other podcast. One of the things that like I try to get my students to understand about exposition is the idea that you don't need to explain something is a white idea. It's not really a white idea, but like it's a dominant culture idea. Right. Because if you're writing a literary novel about a college professor who is like strangely attractive, even though he's balding and, you know, 55, to 19-year-old girls who just want to fling themselves at him, whatever, right? Like you don't have to explain what a university is, what a dorm is, what, you know, French fries are, right? Because it is assumed that we in this culture understand those things.
Correct.
But, you know, what if you did have to explain, like, what if you wrote a literary novel in which you did explain, like, this is what a university is, these are what French fries are, this is, you know, right? And it's like, suddenly it's like, what? But, you know, often people who are from cultures who are not the dominant culture do have to do that explaining. But then MFA programs are like, don't explain things, show, don't tell, blah, blah, blah. You know, throw show, don't tell out the window, especially when it comes to this stuff. Because like, we have to tell people stuff all the time in speculative fiction. And we're kind of used to that, right? Because we're like, well, it's an alien world. Let me explain this alien world to you. But like, to some of the audience, like your Filipina grandmother and her cooking and the way she runs her household is, quote, an alien world. It shouldn't be thought of that way.
Right.
Like, honestly, like, people should just be learning about other things. But, like, that is sometimes the way that it has to be presented in fiction, which sucks. Mm-hmm. Which sucks a lot.
Right.
But, like, that's just how it is.
Right. I was just recently told a story about a white guy with dreads who came about and told a young black woman that... she couldn't be, I can't, like, he could cut his hair and be okay. I mean, literally be okay. Cut your hair and walk down a street and you'll be perfectly fine. I can't cut my skin or change my skin. The audacity, my mind's blown by that happening to you. I'm really sorry that happened. And I really wish I could see what this guy is today. That makes no
well, he's nowhere that I've seen. He ain't told us nothing.
Well, you probably did see him. He just doesn't have dreads anymore, and
he probably so does like, not. I don't know this dude. But yeah, like I actually don't. Every now and then, I'm like, should I look up where he's at? Because every now and then, I think about that conversation. And then I'm like, you know what? No, because no. he was the guy.
If you saw him and he had like on a suit and tie and like his hair was like he looked like somebody that was totally different, you'd be like, okay.
I would tell him that he had betrayed his principles.
Yes. Right. You should say, well, you don't have the experience now anymore, sir.
Right. Right. So, yeah, but I think that, you know, a lot of it comes down to the idea that they don't have to learn, like, that learning about somebody else's culture is like the work of reading an article or two right. on Wikipedia in a day and not, like, something that requires a lot of work. And so, yeah, this is why they don't necessarily call the experts to come in and sensitivity read. You know, and also like the works feed into their pre-existing biases and pre-existing notions about how, quote, those people are. Right. Just like, what was that book that happened? This happened, what? Oh my God, it seems like 50 million years ago, right, that these things happened. But like the last thing that happened where this white woman wrote a story about like a Mexican woman trying to like make it to America.
American dirt.
Yes, American dirt. Oh, like that, yes. That whole thing, like, did nobody, did they call no Latinas in to read this book? No, right. Of course they didn't. Because because what she wrote played into their existing notions about how those people, quote, are. And so they were like, oh, this is fine.
Yeah. And that's why it matters.
The thing about it is they looked her up. And all I did was put in her name and looked at some columns she had done where she didn't acknowledge, she didn't say she was of any ethnicity at all. In fact, I thought she said that she that she was Irish or her husband was Irish or something. Like the whole thing was very suspect. Like the way that she was talking about her husband being an immigrant or whatever. I don't know, last time we start thinking about people that fly on a plane from Dublin in America to America in the 21st century, now they're immigrants. Like What are we talking about? Like, you're talking about he's arrived in another century in Ellis Island, or what, you know, during the potato famine? Like, what are you saying? Like, it was a whole very carefully, it appeared to me, it could be very different, you know, but it appeared to me like a very conscious rebranding, because she understood something that we're talking about tonight or today, is that there's a kind of knowingness of certain narratives that can get through if they are translated in a certain way, you know? And so she reworked herself, rebranded herself to write this book, even rebranding her husband. So it seems like something else than what it actually was when you dive into it, and you didn't have to, dive very far.
You didn't.
So that goes back into the health.
Right.
They made a ton of money on, which they made a ton of money on. Right.
Yeah. And that white people still suggest today. Like, I remember back in May, you know, when we're talking about all the civil unrest, and I was talking about this with the Buddhist group that I sit with. Now, I live in Portland, Oregon. And so there are a lot of white people here. And so it's really hard to find any kind of like grouping in which it's not just like a bunch of white people and you just handle it. You're just like, this is the cost of living in Portland, Oregon. Okay, fine. So I belong to this Buddhist meditation group. And, you know, we're talking about the different things and they're talking about how they have like a reading group where they can discuss like issues of race and whatever. And somebody's like, you know, what's a really good thing to do? You should really watch The Help. That will teach you so much about that. And I'm like, I'm going to go because I don't have the energy to tell these white people that they really shouldn't be reading The Help.
I would have powered up like Goku and said, you need to listen up here. You need to listen here.
I don't have the spoons today for this, but yeah, but it's like it's still like a go-to for a certain kind of white person who's like, yeah, you want to learn about racism, read The Help, watch The Help. I'm like, no, but yeah, it's like like Sheree said, it's like it's a story that they that empowers them somehow, even though it's like allegedly supposed to be about us.
You know, and the worst part is that most of them would consider themselves progressive and allies and all of those things, and yet still very tone deaf.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, definitely. That comes up over and over again. It's like like someone said earlier about like you know you feel like you get a gold star just for having the conversation. Sheree, I think you said that. Mm-hmm. And that's, I don't know, that's what keeps popping up in my head when we think about like how to really promote Own Voices fiction is it's not, there's definitely some major work to be done structurally in the industry, which it seems to be actively resisting it. But also a lot of work to be done on the part of readers, you know, like look deeper, find small presses. That's one thing I always try to tell people to do is like, if this stuff isn't coming from like you can't equate the size of a publishing house with the quality of what's coming out of it. Right. So don't be afraid to look to small presses, you know, go in and find work that is written by the people who stories told by the people who should be telling them. Seek those out, you know, learn about the authors and don't be afraid to get a little bit uncomfortable, meaning don't be afraid to step outside the envelope of, or outside of the, you know, don't be afraid to get outside the bubble of the help and, you know, things that make you feel good and things that center you in the story. You know, like don't be afraid to get outside of that is, I don't know, that's what I feel like readers ought to do. Do you have, Sheree, do you have any, Tempest, do you have any other thoughts on just what readers and writers should particularly consider in order to, you know, keep moving this forward and make it more widely known and more widely accepted?
I just think there's a ton of people being published next year and the years beyond that. Simpa said it was like after people start burning things in Minneapolis, suddenly there was like, you know what? We need that Black content. Where's that project we've been putting on hold for 3-4 years? Let's see if we can get them back on the line and get it moving. Just support the books that are coming out. Read them, talk about them, blog about them, review them. Look outside also the big five or the big four, whatever's going to end up being when they're done. A lot of great stuff is happening from small presses, indie presses. The Black indie presses have been doing this all along, supporting this work all along. So let us not forget the wonderful work that they're doing as well. They certainly could use our support. That's just the main thing. It's about reading the books, right? And it's about supporting the artists and supporting the writers. So that's the main thing, I think, that can happen. And people are pretty excited to get these other stories. It's a different richness. It's a layering of storytelling. It's a lot more details that you get. You can sort of tell that someone from the culture is writing it. Right. Mm-hmm. And you feel, at least for me, I feel more confident about it. Not that they're all like, you know, flawless and that there aren't problems or that we all agree on everything. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That there can't be critiques or whatever, but there are going to be different kinds of conversations, different kinds of problems, not the same ones. And that in and of itself can be refreshing, you know?
The other thing to do is, you know, especially for readers, request that your library buy these books. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a huge thing, you know, because not only is it, you know, more sales, but also it means that like it's in the library system for somebody to find. Mm-hmm. When the pandemic hit, one of the things I did that I had been meaning to do since forever was to like figure out how to get ebooks through my library. Yeah. And my library system is really awesome about like saying, you know, oh, have you seen this book? Like you have put these three books on hold, but did you know about this one over here? And so, but they have to have those books in the system, right? Like if I put, say, you know, Claribel Ortega's Ghost Squad on my Libby and say like, please, I want to read that. And they, you know, don't have anything else that's similar to say to me, oh, while you're waiting for the 17 other people who have requested that book to read it, what about this other author over here, right? And so if they don't have more of books, you know, by Latinx authors or more middle grade books for kids that are Own Voices or whatever to recommend, then that's a problem. So like, ask your library, like, please, you know, carry this book. I want to check it out and read it. And do that for, you know, all the books that you come across. And the other thing is like, now, a few years ago, I suggested a reading challenge and the whole internet told me that I was terrible for doing so. But I continue to say that it's always a good idea as a reader to set yourself a specific challenge of like, okay, for the next however many months or a year, I'm only going to read books written by X kind of person. Right. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I'm only going to read books written by women, and I'm going to define women broadly. So not just cisgender women, but like mm-hmm. women, self-identified women. I'm going to read these books by them. You do that for a year, it's going to change you. I'm only going to read books by BIPOC authors for a year. Mm-hmm. That's going to change mm-hmm. you. And it also means that like, then you have to go like, okay, I got to find these books written by, you know, people from X identity. And then I'm looking through them to see like, okay, like now that I have a list of like, these books that exist, now I got to read the jacket copy to figure out which one of them I want to read. And, you know, you may surprise yourself, like that there may be some concept in there that you're like, oh, I never even thought about it that way. And, but then there's also just the joy of being like, look, it's my favorite science fiction trope, but written by a Black lady.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. I want Black ladies to mess with all the science fiction tropes.
Yes, please.
I love that.
Yes. Yeah.
So one thing that people could do is go and check out, Tempest has quite a few different anthologies, including In the Shadow of the Towers. I was just looking at that one thinking I needed it. And Cherie, you have two anthologies. So if you're looking for authors and you don't know, you know, where to look for it, pick up an anthology like that and, mm-hmm. and find an author that you like, and then go follow their work, find out what else they've written.
Yeah, and I want to put in throw a quick plug for Cherie's book, Nine Bar Blues, also. Yes. I talk about it rather a lot. It has one of the most gorgeous covers I've ever seen, and it's even better inside. The stories are fantastic.
Absolutely. It is the best cover.
Isn't it?
The best. Also, one of the things that I'm super excited about, speaking of like being a person in the room, Cherie is now taken over as the editor of the magazine of science, fantasy and science fiction. Which is super awesome. And it's like, I have like a particular joy from this because I have had a very complicated relationship with FNSF because Gordon Van Gelder and I used to get into it back in the days when we were on forums. People, that's how old we are. So like we're on forums, like battling it out. And I'm like, Gordon Van Gelder, you suck. But you know, Cherie can't say that because he's still the publisher, but, but one of the things
I am who I am. That's why.
That's right.
I got the call. I was like, "You really do."
Like, are you sure?
Cooning person. This is Cherie. You know,
right? Exactly. And that, and like, I was so
never
excited.
Not gonna not say what I think. Never.
Exactly. So I was so excited because it's one of the things like that taught me how much the editor matters was actually my. Like anger at reading fantasy and science fiction when Gordon Van Gelder was the editor. And I just be like, what is this? Because like, there would be some good stories in there because, you know, even somebody who's terrible, like trips across an author who's amazing every once in a while, right? Mm-hmm. But then there was definitely a change in, I felt the quality of stories when Gordon passed it off to C.C. Finley, who's a white dude. But C.C. Finley's taste, my tastes match up a little bit more, but you know, it matters that Cherie is now going to be the editor of this magazine because she brings a completely different point of view as an editor to it. It doesn't necessarily mean that every story is going to be the same kind of story and it's not all going to be blackly black 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 blackly
yeah,
black.
I was telling somebody else, I was like, okay, people, this is a 71, it'll be 72 year old publication.
Yeah.
Right. I'm inheriting some inventory, of course, from Charlie. Charlie and our some of our tastes does overlap. It's considerably less than what he inherited when Gordon passed it on to him. I might add, he probably could have published two more years of just what had been purchased. But it's not going to go suddenly into Fire magazine. So let's not what it's going to do. Fire is fire. Uncanny is uncanny. Strange sure. Horizons is strange horizons, and so on. Apex is Apex, but I would like to see, you know, there be, you know, other writers there and not just, you know, every now and then, or one on the masthead every now and then. You understand what I'm saying? There is so much other good work. I'm waiting to see that good work. I can't wait to January. Don't send me your trunk stories. I don't want your trunk stories. I don't want the old dusty stuff that's been, you know, rejected all over the earth. Don't send that to me. I want your new, great, wonderful work, you know, so that we can get this on topic. You know, solid short stories that are off the chain, or they're just fun, or they're interesting, or, you know, or have your cool voice. You know, that's what I'm looking for. And I do like horror and I do like poetry. So you can send that work to me as well. Nice. And we'll just see. So we'll see how it, you know, how it is and what's going on. But no, you know, people are talking as if I haven't been laboring in these science fiction fields for 25 years. And along with my other hats that I wear, you know, kind of poet, you know, work supported by the Malay Colony, Bread Loaf. I've been doing my thing quietly for a long time, and watching them learn, you know. So I didn't arrive from some raw spaceship and suddenly land.
No, not at all. Right.
I am thoroughly enjoying your rise. It is amazing to watch, and it's something that I hope that you are extremely proud of.
I am tapping on the heads of haters.
Yes, we are proud of you, and we cannot wait to see more out of you.
Yeah,
I'm celebrating. This is a celebration time. I told, listen, we only dropped this news this week, so I told a family member. I said, you got 3 more days of hearing Wakanda Forever, and then I go back to my site.
You've been putting it out there. I've been following it. You have been putting it out there. I've been following it. I'm here for all of it. I am here for all of it.
We've been loving watching it, and especially the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, because that's one of the most storied, you know, like you said, it's an old publication. It's just done. To be put in charge of that as editor is just I can't wait. That's the kind of stuff I grew up reading. Is magazines like that, including that one, and to see you at the helm of it is just super exciting. So big congratulations on
this. What happened? I'm trying my best to see what can happen with these covers, but you know, that is like that's the one thing that Gordon loves. He's the art director. He loves those covers, and they're he's got a stable of artists that do oil paintings and things for him. So we'll see what happens, but don't expect Ebony magazine overnight. So
we know it's going to be great.
Whatever it is overnight,
whatever is going on.
Well, that's why we know it's going to be
out there.
Yeah. and that's
let me get in the door, people.
Right, that's the thing. It's like it's no matter what happens, it's going to be different. It's going to be you, right? Yeah. And it's so wonderful when you have these different editorial voices, like. It, you know, for the longest time, I was just like, if we have another white man who is chosen to pick the best stories of the year, I'm gonna scream. Like, I like some of those white dudes just fine,
right.
But there's just a difference when you have somebody who comes from a different point of view, who's the one who's looking at the stories. Because, you know, there may be stories that were wonderful stories that another editor just won't get. Like, right. They won't see, like, what's great about them because they're bouncing off, you know, things that they don't understand, right? But another editor is going to do it. That's why it's so important that we tackle this on every level. Like, we, you know, we're talking about at the beginning, like, writers got to write some own voices stuff. Like, please, mm-hmm. writers, like, write your own voice is important. It is so important. Please write the stuff. But then, like, stepping up the efforts, because We Need Diverse Books has been doing a thing where they're offering grants to people of color who want to enter into the publishing field. Publishing That's is amazing. A hard field to get into because basically you have to be rich in order to like stick around in publishing. So they're like, well, you gotta be a free intern for this long, and then maybe we'll give you a little bit of money that you can't live off of, and also you gotta live in New York. Right, it's like you gotta know somebody, you have to have all this money, and you know, so a few years ago, I Need Diverse Books like started on the path of like trying to change that. They had a grant for somebody that would like pay for their living expenses while they like started on this path. But now, of course, you know, pandemic has made it so that people are like, well, I guess you don't have to live in New York to do this job anymore. It's like, yeah, it's actually kind of been that way for a while. But thanks for catching up to the rest of us. But a lot of the big publishing houses have been specifically saying, okay, we're hiring an intern. You don't have to move to New York. This is a remote position. Let's go. We hope that Black, Indigenous, and other people of color apply. So maybe that is going to mean that in 5 years, it's going to be a different landscape. And in 10 years, it's going to be a different landscape. Let's keep our fingers crossed that that momentum keeps going forward. But like steps like that, steps like having Sheree as editor of Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, other editors like Nisi Shaw, like just blowing it out of the water with these amazing anthologies, that's all going to make a difference. So I'm crossing my fingers for forward momentum.
I'm reviewing books for Asimov's, which this is the crazy 2020 year. Yeah. First of all, I had news that I already knew that, you know, wasn't, you know, able to announce. And then the other thing happened. And then the other thing happened. The other thing happened. So now I think almost seven of the cats are out of the bag. a few more. But those reviews will appear in the summer. So I've already like done that, because my goal is, of course, to publish more reviews. I mean, that was one of my early things I did. When I first arrived in New York, you know, I was reviewing books for QBR and for Black Issues Book Review. I reviewed Octavia Butler's Pair of the Talents novel for Washington Post Book World. In fact, if you go look at the book and see the quote from the Washington Post, that's my quote. That's from the review. I've reviewed Nalo Hopkinson's first award-winning novel when she won the Warner Aspect Contest for Brown Girl in the Ring. So I'm just returning back to my roots in terms of the reviewing, but it'll be for Asimov's. And with a special interest in, of course, covering works that are coming from people of color, because I don't think they get covered enough or widely, you know. So we'll see how that goes. But creating more space for other people to do the work that other people have been doing all along. Yeah, that's what I think.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for doing the work. You and Tempest both of you in your different ways just contribute so much to the community and to the literature and just to everything else. We really appreciate the work that you do. And where can people, let's start with you, Sheree, where can people find you to keep up with your unbelievable number of cats that you keep letting out of the
my lovely, 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 lovely herds of cats. Yep. ShereeReneeThomas.com is my website. You can also find me milling around on Twitter at Black Pot Mojo. Okay. And I'm occasionally on Instagram, though it's not really my realm. I like to watch videos and look at fashion and Afrofuturism posts, which are barely about Afrofuturism. I don't know why. Like, why is it labeled as Afrofuturism? It's Afro. But okay. Under my name, Sheree Renee Thomas. And I guess on Facebook too, on Sheree Renee Thomas, which has a hodgepodge of everybody I've ever known in my life on there. So all
right. That'll be interesting.
all realms from elementary school on up, you know.
Oh god. Yeah. And we'll put that info in the show notes as well, so people can find you easily. We'll put all the links in there. How about you, Tempest? Where should people look for you and find you and your work online?
You can go to my website at ktempestbradford.com, and that pretty much has links to everything, including my Patreon. And I'm on most of the social medias, but generally right now, these days, I'm on Twitter the most, because it's the easiest, but it's also the devil. So you mostly find me there being like, this place is the devil. Also, look at the funny bird. My cat. so that's where you can generally find me.
Awesome. Well, thank you both very much for taking the time out of your schedules to talk to us about this. It's really been a lot of fun. And once again, thank you so much for the work you just keep on contributing to the field. It's so much and it's such great quality. We just appreciate it greatly. And if anyone wants to stream our episodes, we are at glitchypancakes.com, or you can find us on your favorite podcast app. Go ahead and subscribe, rate, review, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find me online at Jesse_A_Adams. We're also, Glitchy Pancakes is also on Twitter at Glitchy Pancakes and Facebook as well. Allie, where can they find you?
You can find me pretty much anywhere on the internet at Allie911. It's Allie911.
Cool. Rob?
And I'm not as convenient as Allie. You can find me on Twitter at EI Blackout. That's at IAIBLACKOUT. I just started using Snapchat. I'm still confused about it. And I have a Facebook account with my name and my face on it. And it has, like Cherie says, just a bunch of people from like first grade. Well, no, not first grade technically, but like high school and like everywhere. And then like, you know, yeah, that place, that cesspool. But I'm on Twitter. I'm trying to be on Twitter more. I'm not on Twitter as much. I need to be on Twitter more because that's where people want to, you know, go and talk to me about things.
Right.
Anyway, yes. Thank you very much, everyone. We appreciate having you on. Thank you for listening to Pancakes. Thank you to Tempest.
Can I say one more thing?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wakanda forever.
There you go.
Love it. Forever.
Yes. That's right.
Awesome.
That is right. Let's go. This has been a crazy year for us. Cherie was our first guest, and
like, in the middle of the pandemic, right?
Right, in the middle of the pandemic. And like, and she will be one, and she's the first guest we've had come back.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing. This is simply amazing. I cannot wait to have you back again so we can promote all the things that you are doing.
All the teams. I cannot wait.
All of them. We appreciate you both for doing the work that you do. Mm-hmm. And we appreciate everyone for listening. Thank you. I'll have a good night.
Thank you for having us.
No problem.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone, and goodbye.